It's like any beautiful, long-haired, wonderful-looking indigenous storyteller. I'm gonna drop you right in the middle of the action. Aho!
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 470 for the week of July 31st, 2023. I am shit-ass David T. Cole, and I'm here with cryptic aphorism, Sarah D. Bunting.
You're better off looking up than around.
Trash donut Tara Ariano.
I'm free.
And star person Allison Herman.
Love eggplant.
I do have a question about that, but we'll get to it. Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. Joining us, she is a TV critic at Variety. You have heard with us here before. Welcome back, Allison Herman.
Welcome back,
Allison.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be back.
We're thrilled to have you to talk about season three of Reservation Dogs. For this third and final season, we pick up with the shit asses where season two left them, stranded in Los Angeles, having fulfilled their late friend Daniel's dearest wish by standing in the ocean together. Now they have to go back to real life. Alora Dannon's Aunt Teenie calls out fake sick from work and journeys from Arizona to put them on a bus and bring them back to O'Kern. Bear's spirit friend William Knifeman has a different mission for Bear to go on first, but over the season's first few episodes, everyone makes their way home with new questions about what they want home to be. And if you're listening to this the day it came out, two episodes dropped on FX on Hulu. We got the first four. We will be careful about plot spoilers. Let's do the Chen check-in. Allison, should our listeners watch Reservation Dogs?
Absolutely.
Sarah.
God, yes.
Dave.
Yeah.
Without reservation, I would say yes. Sorry.
No.
So let's get into why. Other than the interjections from William Knifeman, this two-part premiere felt more muted, I think, than the premieres of the first two seasons. I felt a little like the people who were maybe jumping on after watching the first season when it actually aired on regular-ass FX this summer might find it too downbeat. Allison, what did you think about the premiere episodes kicking off? Did you also feel it had a bit of a quieter tone?
A little bit, just because the end of season two, I thought, was this beautiful emotional crescendo. Like, I literally cannot think about it without tearing up a little bit. And I think you're catching the kids at this moment of like, okay, and now what? Which I think, frankly, like, fits with where they are at, where they've, you know, gotten themselves all the way to the other side of the country. They've literally never left their home state before. They've released all this emotion. And then they have to look up and be like, oh, yeah, now we have to like logistically answer the question of how we get home without a car or money. And I think that leads to a little more low key of an episode than season two, episode 10. But I mean, that's not really saying much because that was such a high point.
Yeah.
I think the next part of what they're answering is where everybody goes at the end of the series. Mm-hmm. Who's staying? Who's leaving? Mm-hmm. The journey of season three, probably, you know, from a at least from a, you know, end game perspective. And I thought that maybe the writers, seeing that the end is near, were also inserting into the episode mix topics they haven't tackled head on, things they wanted to talk about, and they have one more season to do, because even though just two episodes have rolled out, what you're going to get across the first four episodes are some sort of like very pointed looks at some issues with some returning characters from past seasons. It is muted compared to some of the more comedic episodes in the past, but some big choices are being made. So I think it's earned. You know, there is an episode coming up. I think it's the third episode that's very heavy.
Yeah.
And, but it was excellent. And I was really glad to see that. Trying to be careful, talk around what it's about. But I was really happy to see that character back and see some sort of resolution to that. And it plays into the journey that one of the characters is going on, that Bear is going on. I think everything is earned in this show. That's the thing. It's like whether it is a lighter episode or a heavier episode, they never miss on the tone and getting it right.
Yeah, I feel like it's different show when the four leads are together than when you see just one of them on their own. And Sarah, this was your first glimpse of Cheese since we talked about his big season two episode for the canon back in June. How did he change for you seeing him, you know, with his best friends, with white Jesus on the bus, etc.?
He didn't really
change for me. I was struck, as I always am, because I haven't been watching this all the way along. It's like something that I'm saving for myself to go back to the beginning and start at the beginning because I know that I'm going to love it. I already love the show. I just haven't been watching it all along. Mm-hmm. But I was struck in these opening episodes by how the fact that no matter where I drop down in this story with these people, I know enough. Because the show has realized whatever world you happen to be in a given episode so fully and is confident enough to not sort of identify a single tone that it needs to be. That it's like there is poetry, but also laughter in the quotidian bullshit of bus travel. A lot of that is funny and a lot of it is beautiful. And then the little like map with the bus like color form on it is like, it's silly, but it's also kind of beautiful and sweet and how like simple it is. And this man that Bear comes across and his feelings about star people and eggplant supply is, I mean, it's hilarious. And like, look, I spend a lot of time with true crime crackpot theorists, and so this is a recognizable type, but it was the show was so compassionate towards this man. So whichever show I'm getting when I drop into it at whatever time is like I attach to it. Mm-hmm. So that's really something about this show that, like, yes, I think it is funnier when all four of them are together, but I don't need it to be funny. I don't need to be cheese to be any particular kind of way. And I think that's because the show has a kind of radical emotional acceptance of all of its characters, whether they're leads or not. Mm-hmm. I was especially also struck by the fact that a lot of shows would have written Bear's responses to this literal tinfoil-hatted guy as very like teenage snarky. But this show actually is able to hear its own characters way better, I think, than a lot of shows are. So, I mean, it's so good. I'm always like thrilled all over again that it exists.
Allison, you were nodding. You agree.
Yeah. I think my line about this show, sort of for the entirety and of its run, has always been that it feels like the truest successor to Atlanta.
Yes.
And not just because they're both produced on FX.
Yes, yes.
But they both have this feeling of, obviously, you have this circumstance where it's a marginalized community who you're not really used to seeing afforded this level of creative control, both in front of and behind the camera within Hollywood. Mm-hmm. You get the feeling that results from that, which is that it's not really attempting to speak to a wider audience. It is simply letting us observe the sort of in-jokes or shared knowledge and not explaining itself. And then it also has this like total formal flexibility where you could start any episode and it could be all four of the protagonists hanging out together. And that's a show we love to watch. It could be a spotlight episode about a supporting character. It could be almost like completely out of the continuity of the show, as one of the episodes that was given to us as critics basically is. And because it is confident in itself and because it has afforded itself this leeway and because it's able to excel on all these different levels, you as an audience member are completely willing to go along with that in a way that I think really speaks to how much Sterling Harjo and his team have accomplished in such a short time. And the fact that we're going into this season, knowing it's the final season, I was just thinking about how I couldn't believe how deep my emotional attachment to how wide a variety of characters has become over the course of just two seasons. And in my review, I was sort of two minds where I was like, they've so thoroughly established this world and shown that there's threads to be pulled in every which direction that this could run for like 10 seasons if they really wanted it to. And mm-hmm. It could just keep spiraling off and keep building out this world. But I really respect the creators' decision to make this a very focused story about a very small group of kids and this very particular journey they're going on of processing loss and entering into this adult world of big irreconcilable problems right as they're on the cusp of adulthood. And I think it's the episodes we were given are setting up a really good conclusion, but also I think giving us a sense of what we'll be missing once this is not going to be around.
Yeah. I absolutely agree. And I think throughout the run, The show has created a magical realist atmosphere too. And, you know, Sarah, you were touching on this with the second episode with Maximus, a character played by the wonderful Canadian actor Graham Greene. But whenever we see any character interacting with William Knifeman, it doesn't seem like it necessarily means anything about them or their mental health. And even Maximus, I feel like, seems like he's basically fine until we actually get a view of the world from his perspective at the end of the episode when he thinks the star people are there, and then we can see, no, it's just the cops. So I can't tell. It seems like there's been more talk in this season about, like, people, including Maximus, telling Bear, like, people are going to think you're crazy. And I don't know if that's a story that they're going to explore. Allison, what did you think? Was that something that that's actually going to go anywhere, or this is just part of the environment that he exists in?
It felt like very much, especially the end of that episode, felt like it's really like we're walking away from this and we're not necessarily going to come back to it. But what I loved about that episode is that one of the things that I love that Reservation Dogs is able to do is that it centers a lot of episodes and plot lines around very specific, you know, social issues that are affecting the Native community in places like Oklahoma. But it doesn't feel like it's a very special episode, PSA. Not that there's anything wrong with those kinds of episodes, but it felt like an episode about a person who we never met before who is dealing with mental illness, and specifically the intersection between mental illness, poverty, and state intervention, without feeling like it's capital A about those things, and treating Maximus as not like a mascot for those issues. He feels very much like a fully realized individual. And you also get that beautiful moment where he's playing old footage of his friends. And the point is, like, the Reservation Dog story, as specific and individual as it feels, could be any one of the stories that has happened throughout the centuries and the decades. And I didn't feel like we're necessarily going to come back to that given the limited time we have left, but it felt like in that limited time, they made the most of it. I felt like they told a complete story and made the point about this person without feeling like they were using this character just for Bear's larger journey.
Yeah. I agree. The other story about Maximus, too, is that, like, this was him with his friends in the home movies, but he's not that now. He's on his own. And I feel like that's sort of part of the larger story that the show's been telling from the beginning. It's like, what is home? What do we get from community? What does it mean when you leave? I mean, there's certainly a lot of that last season when Alora's grandmother dies and Teenie comes home, and, like, that's a big part of her story, too. And I was pleased to see Teenie come back as well and sort of progress that, not only with her as a whole person versus just a person who left, and that she has things to tell Alora that, you know, Alora needs to learn in terms of making her own decisions about her future, too.
Yeah, I think something the show has done in terms of very subtly and gradually setting an emotional arc for these characters is at the beginning of the show, they're dealing with this very acute loss of their friend who took his own life before the events of the series. But in the aftermath of that, they're dealing with loss in their own ways. They're having a lot of trouble reconciling each other's sort of different visions for what they want their lives to be like. And I think the implication is that Daniel was sort of a connecting bridge between them. And it becomes this real source of conflict that certain of the kids really want to leave and build new lives for themselves. Certain kids want to stay, even among the kids who want to leave. You know, originally it was just Alora and Bear were going to go to California together. And then it's this real gut punch when Alora decides to go with Jackie, who's another teenager in town who is originally kind of an antagonist. And, you know, you have the full circle moment of everyone coming together and going to California as a whole group in the end of season two. But in the aftermath in season three, I think what you start to get, even in the limited amount of time that you see of just the force of together, you see a real acceptance of, like, okay, we don't want the same things. We're not going to be here together forever. But that doesn't mean we dislike each other or any less valuable to each other, and or that we're not going to embrace or make the most of the time we have. And it feels like this very adult, it's a very, like, subtle arc for a coming of age story, I think, to go from, you know, really having difficulty accepting your differences and distance from your friends to being able to hold in your head that, like, these are my friends and we're not going to do everything together all the time. And that's okay.
Yeah. But you brought it up already. Is eggplant only for star people?
I am an eggplant lover myself. I have friends who think it is bitter or mushy in texture, and I think they simply have not discovered the right preparation for them. I just purchased a vegetable cookbook. I'm very excited to try the eggplant recipes. I would be very sad if I were told I could not use my eggplant crop and had to save it for star people. But that is Maximus's choice, and I respect it.
Turning into the vegetarians, Sarah.
It's a relative of the deadly nightshade, as is the tomato, which I have tattooed on me. So I found this, and also its other life as an emoji. A very interesting choice.
Dave.
Barta, if you get it at the Indian restaurant, fantastic. One of the best uses of an eggplant and one of my favorite dishes. So I'm pro eggplant.
Same.
I'm against. Mm. I guess that means I'll be left behind.
Okay, it's time to go around the dial talking about things we've been watching on TV recently. First off is with Tara.
Season 2 of This Fool came out on Hulu last week. Dave and I did not ration the episodes. We watched all 10. Now we're out and we are sad. I think that we have talked about the show before on the podcast. Chris Estrada co-created it with Matt Ingebretson and Jake Wiseman from Corporate and Pat Bishop, who directed several episodes of this season. Chris Estrada also stars as Julio. In the first season, he worked at a gang rehabilitation organization called Hugs Not Thugs, where he sort of helped and sort of tortured his cousin Luis, who had just been released from prison and also lived at Julio's mother's house with Julio. Hugs Not Thugs lost its funding at the end of the first season in spectacular fashion, which I will not ruin for anyone who hasn't watched it yet, because you should. But at the start of the second season, Julio and Luis have switched roles. Luis has a job as a security guard at a suit store, where, by the way, his boss, just whenever anyone is in a suit, he will say, "You look like the that person's race, James Bond." So it's like, "You look like the Guatemalan James Bond. You look like the Taiwanese James Bond." Julio is nihilistic and depressed and unemployed. Both of them are living in a neighbor's garage, which is not great when Luis gets a girlfriend. By the way, she works at that one grocery store from every TV show ever. You, when you see it, will know. It is the one where Barry has the huge fight in Ronnie Lilly from Barry. I digress. The show writes itself into a corner pretty early on, and seeing how the story unfurls in a way that feels surprising but also inevitable is, I think, a real joy. But the world of the show is also big enough to let them step away from Julio and Luis and have a whole Hitchcock spoof episode this season with Lois Smith and Julio's mother, who retires from her job cleaning offices and then realized right away she didn't have a plan for what she was going to do with all her time. She tells her friends on her last day, "I'm going to garden." And then on her first day of retirement, she's like in the garden and then looks at her watch and it's 7:05 a.m. She's like, "Oh, no." I don't think it's a spoiler to say, since he's in the trailer, Michael Imperioli is back as Minister Payne. I don't know why they always say minister instead of reverend. That's a question I would love explored by someone. Anyway, we get a whole episode seeing what he's been up to since the gang rehab fell apart, which is so good. Excellent showcase for David Arquette, of all people. I'm not a crackpot, but if Michael Imperioli was going to get an Emmy nomination for work that he did in 2022, it should have been for season one of This Fool, not The White Lotus. Show's really funny, really well written, really well observed. There are only 20 episodes total. Feel free to savor them the way that we definitely did not do. Dave, you also, of course, watched this with me. Yeah. Anything to add?
Let me ask you this. Do you love to laugh?
I do love to laugh.
Well, yeah, check out This Fool.
Yes, Minister Cole.
Yes. It's great. Yeah, Michael Imperioli is really funny. It's nice to see him being comedic and unhinged.
Yes.
There's a lot of talk about his giant hog. So.
It's like more of a plot point than you might expect. But yes, it is. He's very funny as a side character. It is mostly a showcase for Chris Estrada, as I mentioned, and Frankie Quinones, who plays Luis, who is also so great and comes back to what we do in the shadows after a memorable earlier guest shot in a episode, I think, either this week or next week. One of the two. So look out for him. This Fool on Hulu. Check it out. For my plug, Citadel is a show that I've been complaining about a lot ever since I was made to watch it. So when our friends at Appointment Television decided to do a deep dive on every episode of Citadel, I was like, please let me come on and complain about the show some more. And they very graciously did. So that is a podcast that is done by three past guests of this show, Catherine Van Arendonk, Andrew Cunningham, and Margaret Willison. And we will link my episode in the show notes, but you should listen to them all because this show is insane. And the people need to know.
All right, Allison, what do you got for us?
I have Minx, season two, which is airing on Stars and notably not on Max, where it aired season one and shot most of season two and then was told, sorry, you don't have a home anymore. Luckily, its studio Lionsgate happened to just have a spare TV network lying around that needed programming. They have survived and come back. And for those unfamiliar, it is a period comedy question mark about a semi-fictional women's magazine that combines, you know, the intellectual feminist coverage of Miss with the flagrant, explicit hard R pornography of Playgirl or Maxim or what have you, featuring men and speaking of large hogs. So running theme today. Mm-hmm. It is really nice seeing the characters that you thought you might not ever see again. It stars Ophelia Lovibond, incredible name, as Joyce Prigger, the editor, Jake Johnson as her partner, who's kind of based on Bob Guccione and really like nails the dirtbag vibe. But the supporting cast is also incredible. And one thing I really love about the season is it gives them a chance to shine. I think I have a soft spot for Lennon Parham as Joyce's older sister, who kind of goes on her own journey of sexual self-discovery. But the sort of theme of the season is that the cast is now experiencing success as opposed to trying to get the magazine off the ground. And it's, you know, the high-flying 70s, cocaine everywhere, deep throat premieres, cameos, quote-unquote, from like every 70s celebrity you can possibly think of, from like Jackson Brown to Joan Didion. Which I think if it were on Max, I would maybe be a little frustrated that there's sort of a lack of conflict that comes with that for the first half to two-thirds of the season. And then the conflict gets introduced very later on and feels like, oh, we have to set up season three. But because there was that real risk that Minx would just kind of cease to exist, there's a real meta catharsis to being like, oh, I formed a detachment and now I get to see these fake people succeed and achieve their dreams. And Elizabeth Perkins comes in doing like full Elizabeth Perkins mean rich lady mode. She's doing that on Minx and on the After Party this season. So congrats to her agent.
Having previously done it on Glow as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the woman has a niche, but she really owns it. And I just really enjoyed it. It's 8 episodes. You will shotgun it so fast you cannot believe. And I think it's just done a great job cultivating this cast, and I hope they continue to have the opportunity to do so into the future.
Yeah. The first two episodes are all we've seen, but they were really funny. And especially in the second episode, the deep throat screening, the ways they incorporated Warren Beatty without actually showing him, I thought were really funny and creative.
There's also the disembodied voice of Robert Evans, who I now see as Matthew Good in my mind. Uh-huh. After,
but the idea, like, you don't really think about it, but if you wanted to watch a porn at home, you had the reel back in the day. Yeah. And it's like, he didn't want to give up his porn reel.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you have to plug for us, Allison?
I will just plug that I now work at Variety, and I no longer work at The Ringer, where I was for 7 years. So I will just plug that I have many reviews that you can read, most recently Reservation Dogs, which you can also read in the magazine edition of Variety, which is now a thing that I can write for.
That's so cool.
Fancy. Congratulations. All right, check the show notes for the digital part of that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Sarity Bunting, what have you been watching recently?
Nothing involving eggplants, real or figurative, I'm afraid. I'm here to talk about Hunted, because I wondered recently in another venue, what if The Amazing Race, but people on the lam / dropping off the grid? A correspondent promptly tipped me to a UK show from the mid-teens that is, per this correspondent, the darkest Amazing Race. It is called Hunted. I checked out the second series. It's on YouTube. Here's the premise. 10 contestants, largely in pairs, but with a couple of lone wolves in the mix, quote, have to disappear in one of the most watched countries in the world. End quote. If they can stay out for 28 days, they will win part of, unclear, £100,000, but an elite team of hunters armed with the power of the state is after them. And you know what cops really hate? Getting showed up. So even though this isn't real pursuit, the Hunter HQ squad is breaking into mobile phones and laptops, launching media campaigns with wanted posters, interrogating accessories, getting twatty with shop employees and kindly Samaritans who help the runners. They're flying drones into the sides of buildings. They're putting hungover tryhards in half Nelsons. The works. So my interest in a show like Hunted proceeds primarily from the process aspect of prison breaks, like the strategy of purposeful disappearances. The Fugitive, the movie, was great at this, actually. I can name several books whose descriptions of failed disappearances and prison breaks got good and processy. Hunted is only okay at this part. The show's failure to define its own terms is a problem. It for fugitives and hunters, but also for aid and abettors in the citizenry, snitches, whoever. I'm probably not going to continue with it because I don't have a solid grasp of what's permitted. And the editing doesn't quite distract from the variable stakes. So I have more questions than I do investment. Like, can these fugitives break laws? Which ones? How much latitude do the hunters have to, quote, brace witnesses? What are accessories told about compliance with law enforcement? Was the show well enough known, at least in series two, that that would have Heisenberged civilian participation? Hunted is not of no interest, especially because it has a way of showing law enforcement's ass in spite of law enforcement's obvious desire to look awesome. But it's hard to get as invested when you don't know the rules. Good luck to everyone, especially the guy wearing a full suit of Spanish moss to hop over a property line. Yes, Tara.
Dave reminded me of this and I totally forgot. There was an American version of this in 2017 and we covered it on this podcast.
Oh my God.
So,
which episode of this podcast was that?
142. I already dropped it into our show notes. So shout out to Monty Ashley because he was our guest that week. But yeah, I guess it had more success in the UK than it did here.
It was part of a time in our history.
Yes.
Where there were, if I recall, like a whole bunch of surveillance shows.
Well, there was that Wisdom of the Crowd thing with Jeremy Piven.
That crossed with law enforcement. Yes. It was just like this creepy 1984-ish vibe that was like, isn't this cool? Or like, no.
Yeah. Like, that's the other thing. Like, I think, and I say this in my review at bestevidence.fyi, but if they were just a little bit more overtly on the side of the fugitives, quote unquote, but they're obviously not because they're called fugitives and not, you know, justice seekers or whatever.
Right.
So yeah, I do have a full review of that. I have a review of Jarrett Kobeck's second book about the Zodiac. I recently reviewed Derf Backderf's excellent Kent State graphic history. All of that and much, much more at bestevidence.fyi. The true crime that's worth your time every weekday.
I just realized I forgot to mention something about Reservation Dogs that I enjoyed, which was calling ramen spaghetti soup. It's something I'll be stealing. Spaghetti soup. All right. Coming up right here on the next Extra Extra Hot Great this Friday, it is the August 1988 commercial compilation show.
Woo!
We watched every part of Police Academy 2, their first assignment, that wasn't Police Academy 2, their first assignment on NBC.
Yep.
And we're going to talk about a good number of selections of commercials from that airing back in 88. Add to that a TV 101 pilot Farsening, a show that I thought was something totally different than what we actually watched. That is available to supporters. Go to extrahotgreat.com/club to join today. And then right here on the next EHG Prime next week, it is Only Murders in the Building Season 3. And we welcome fresh new guest David Weeb for that. It is time for the Extra Hot Great Canon. Presenting this week is Tara Ariano.
The last time we discussed Girls 5 Eva, our friend Joe Reed was pitching Season 1, Episode 6, Cease and Desist, in which various challenges are confronted and overcome at a Pride event. By the way, while I was preparing this presentation last night, I texted him just, Fledge Mulholland, and that was it. And he replied, Fledge Mulholland, in all caps, so it lives on. Now we are checking back in with the girls precisely one season later to see how things have evolved. And here is why I think Season 2, Episode 6, BPE, is worthy of induction into the canon. Number one, John Lutz. Since the last canon pitch about the show, the Girls 5 Eva has signed with the Property Brothers label, Property Records. Now, well into the recording process with the season nearly over, label rep Tate warns the band members to clean up any internet snail trails that could get them bad publicity. Gloria is unconcerned. Clip one.
I got zero skeletons, except the one in me.
Wait, didn't we wear Bill Clinton as innocent shirts somewhere?
The villain from the Ryan Murphy miniscaries?
Boy, the world was slow to get that one right.
But we were all under Jay Leno's spell.
Did we wear those in Peabag?
What in Zendaya's scorched earth is Peabag?
After you ditched us to go solo and Ashley joined her eighth girl group, Lip City, we did a pilot for a hidden camera show.
It was called Peabag. Pranked by a girl.
It was hilarious.
Anyway.
Gloria digs up the Peabag pilot, and after agreeing that Lifetime Raw really should have had a chance to take off as a cable network, Gloria and Summer revisit one of the pranks. They let a guy named Percy think he was trying out for a job as a limo driver, then distracted him, threw a dummy at the car, and made him think he had run over Gloria. And whoops, both Gloria and the dummy were in Bill Clinton was innocent t-shirts. Summer is horrified by the show, but Gloria thinks that Percy did fine with his Bertucci's gift card and a copy of the tape, which they now have to get back from him. Percy, who is played by John Lutz, is still living at the same address on his original release. After screaming in horror at the sight of Summer and Gloria on his porch and letting the viewer know Percy was the target of all of the pranks in the Peabag pilot, he lets Gloria and Summer in to catch up. Unfortunately, Percy is not doing great. Clip two.
So funny.
So loved it. Oh, I'm free pie.
Hey, Percy, you know, I didn't see a limo out front. Are you still into that?
Or? No, not really craving the open road, you know? Kind of comfy up in here. I make a decent living sticking my face in fresh bread for strangers online. I'm Real Doughboy 81 on OnlyFans.
Hey, do you happen to have a copy of that pilot that we gave you? We kind of wanted to buy it off you. You know, just for our archives. How about $60?
$60? I'd do it for less.
Okay.
Let's see here. Hey, remember when you trapped me in an elevator so long I had to pee in a quarter? And then you opened the doors and there was my mom?
There's more to say about Percy, but for now, I just want to celebrate John Lutz. Percy is not the first and probably will not be the last John Lutz character who makes the viewer feel a complicated mix of contempt and tenderness, because this is what John Lutz was apparently made for. We are lucky to have him, and every sitcom Tina Fey has ever had a hand in is very lucky. Number two, it reconsiders the band members' victim narrative. The through line for the show's first season was simple. What happens when girls who were exploited by music industry predators become adults who still want to be artists? Lots of jokes were made at the expense of their abusive ex-manager, cultural influencers who mixed and matched them with other briefly famous artists, and in Summer's case, the evangelical parents who pushed her into marriage to Kev, an almost certainly gay and closeted boy bander. Some of these also cross into season two, but by episode six, the band members have made so many breakthroughs in terms of figuring out the kind of band they want to be now that they really should be owning their BPE. What is BPE? Thank you for asking. Clip three.
BPE. Kick down the doors, no locks. I don't need a key. Eyes down here, yeah. I'm the centerpiece, animal queen, feel feline synergy. Kicking down the doors, big pussy energy.
So yeah, it's big pussy energy, but Dawn may have a hard time claiming hers. Wiki wants to snatch up all of the solos on the album, but she might not be able to grab the one on And Daughter. Tate suggests they have auditions to see who the best fit is. Wiki, who has only ever lost at singing once as a preteen when she faced off against the stand-up comedy of Mario Cantone on the finals of Star Search, isn't worried, even though the song is specifically about Dawn's grandmother. But Wiki still takes herself out for her pre-audition ritual, karaoke. When she runs into Dawn's husband, Scott, out with some teachers, she is excited to watch him embarrass himself, only to see him absolutely slay Total Eclipse of the Heart. The lesson Wiki takes from this moment is not to let a man intrude on the band's career and declares that she will not be auditioning. But after she leaves, Dawn does audition and get it, and a fight ensues back home. Wiki doesn't know why Dawn didn't just ask for the solo if she wanted it, like a normal person. And Dawn doesn't know why Wiki didn't just offer it, like a normal person. Dawn storms out, leaving Wiki to pick a fight with the next available person. Clip four.
Hey, Max is taking a rare nap, so if you and Dawn are still fighting, can you do it in harsh whispers that'll blend in with the white noise machine?
I'm not fighting. Your wife did sneakiness and beat me unfair and round.
Wow, that's a very good voice level. Thank you.
Maybe she learned to sneak from you. What is your deal? You have a voice like Lenny Kravitz's penis. And you hide it under a bushel? That is a sin.
And even Lenny's penis busted out eventually.
Your light should shine before others. But in a wildly different genre than mine, so I don't see you as competition.
Don't worry. I just sing for fun.
Then how do you know who wins?
When did singing become all about winning for you?
October 16th, 1995.
The Million Man March?
It's not that, but we'll come back to it. At the studio, when Don bitches about the incident to Gloria and Summer, they exchange a pointed look. Not only did Summer overhear Don suggesting to Tate that they hold auditions, but they have a name for this passive-aggressive move. It's a backdoor Don, and she even pulled in on the friend she accompanied to the original Girls 5 Eva auditions before, completely undermining that friend and pretending it was all out of her hands. Dawn has an epiphany. She doesn't ask for the things she wants so that she won't be sad if she doesn't get them. Meanwhile, Wiki tracks down Mario Cantone, who she faced off against on that fateful day that was also the date of the Million Man March, for an impromptu Star Search rematch at a bodega, clip 5.
There is a house in New Orleans, and it's called the Rising Sun. And it's been the ruin of many a poor girl. And Lord, I know I'm one.
Who's it gonna be, boy?
You want me to pick?
Yes! Please, God, please, God.
I don't know. I guess him, because he's buying something.
I could buy something! A Q battery, a master lock, and I'll take all your lukewarm, unpeeled, hard-boiled eggs.
Hey, you can't let Star Search get to you. That show didn't even make sense. How do you compare singers and stand-up? It's apples and oranges.
We sell those. By the huge dusty space heaters.
And I only won in 95 because a musician won the year before. Remember? The 5-year-old country singer? You know, 3 years later she was 8 and there was nothing novel about her anymore.
So the competition wasn't fair?
No, it was just a comedian's turn to win. It's better for ratings if they mix it up. Star Search was only doing what's best for the show. She bought all the eggs?
Also, meanwhile, Gloria puts in an old VMAs tape, seeing herself get hoisted up by the crotch by her boy band member co-presenter and pretend to be cool with it, finally makes Gloria see what Summer has been trying to tell her through the whole episode. What they put Percy through was cruel and they need to make it up to him, which Summer helps arrange with a prank that blows up Gloria's car. Wiki returns from the Star Search do-over to learn from Scott that losing can have advantages, like fueling her career since her Leslie Golden body days. And Dawn returns with a pledge to be more direct from now on. So, Gloria learns that although it is true that the early aughts were a real low point for empathy, being jerked around in her career doesn't make it okay that she did it to Percy. Dawn learns that she actually has power now, so she doesn't have to keep managing up in the same sneaky way she used to do when she was a basically powerless teenager. And Wiki learns that as a Star Search loser, she's on a list with Drew Carey and Beyonce. And number 3, this episode has great songs and so many of them. Guys, let's just hear some songs. Clip 6.
When I cry at a movie, I'm really crying about myself. Only sad that lady's dying, cause I'm thinking about myself.
There's a full version of that one over the closing credits. If you haven't listened to it, go back and do so. Will I Die on a Toilet Too is one of the lyrics in there. We also get clip 7.
This one's going to be catnip for the Property Brothers.
Whoa, oh, oh, kitchen reveal, the couple liked it.
Clip 8.
No presents, no fun. Dirty huts in the blazing sun. Do they know it's a funky Christmas?
gorgeous three-part harmony on the big BPE sing-along gets me every damn time, clip 9.
Stepping out, done playing it small. Ooh. Taking over, yeah, wall to wall. Going up like a cannonball. It's BPE, yo.
BPE, got that big pussy energy. Yeah, yeah, yeah. BPE.
Audience, no judges.
Got it. Damn it. BPE, got that big pussy energy. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Kick down the doors, no locks, I don't need a key. Eyes down here, yeah, I'm the centerpiece. Animal queendom, feline synergy. Kicking down the doors, big pussy energy. Hey!
It's just us. You know, it's actually freeing because who cares what you two think? Come on!
Nothing to prove, don't care if you like me. Swagger that says you just met somebody. Confidence boosted by vitamin P. Kicking down the doors, big pussy energy.
Square feet, I'm going for miles. Upgrade, bringing up the aisles. Open up those class of 5,000. They can find me on Tuesday.
Big pussy energy.
Done!
You said you wanted a solo.
Well, get your big pussy up and take it! Uh-huh, okay!
BPE, got that big pussy energy. Yeah, yeah, yeah. BPE, got that big pussy energy. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Got that big pussy energy. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Kick down the door, no loss, I don't want it. I know, yeah, yeah. I'm the centerpiece, animal queen, no feline synergy. Kicking down the door, big pussy energy.
Really love how they just punch the P every time. Anyway, if you have anything bad to say about this presentation, please do it in harsh whispers so I can't quite make it out. Otherwise, I hope you'll agree that what the canon needs is some BPE. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tara. Allison, do you want to take a first crack at the episode and Tara's presentation of...
Far be it from me to deny any reminder that we are in the Tina Fey extended universe that John Lutz belongs in every version of. I did enjoy the ironic shout out to Ryan Murphy miniseries about the 90s, considering that Tina Fey herself participated in probably the last ever unflattering portrayal of Marcia Clark in Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, right in time for Ryan Murphy to revise that entire caricature like a year later. So I'm glad that the Tina Fey team has come around on that. I love this show so much. I loved this episode. I agreed that the Property Brothers and crying at the movie songs are highlights of an episode that is named after a song, which I think is great. I also just love, I believe it was the critic and writer Esther Zuckerman who once observed that every single Tina Fey show has a Jenna Maroney, even mm-hmm. if it is not literally Jenna Maroney.
Yes.
If, you know, it could be Nicole Richie. It could be a different Jane Krakowski character. and here it is Renee Elise Goldsberry, who I just, it's like the great surprise of the show, just because everyone knows that she's obviously an incredible vocal talent. But I don't think anyone expected her to follow up smashing Broadway success with just an incredible scene stealing sitcom performance. And I think this episode is a wonderful spotlight for that. And finally, I just think Paula Pell could literally make the phone book funny. Like, the way she pronounces words is just inherently comedic in a way that I don't think I've seen with any other performer. So any Gloria action, whether or not her character once thought Bill Clinton was innocent, is welcome in my book. So wonderful presentation, highlighted great aspects of a wonderful episode.
Thank you, Sarah.
I love the performances in the show, and I wrote down many lines that are funny slash that I'm stealing, but there is something about this show that it's less than the sum of the parts for me. I don't know exactly what is missing. Like, I love this performance from Paula Pell. I thought the whole, like, every single line delivery in John Lutz's section of the plot was brilliant. Like, that he shrieks at something and then he's like, oh, it was just a cloud. And there really was like a novella in that line about what this person's life has been like since getting pee bagged. There's just something at times in a Tina Fey product where the cleverness is very, like, just standing back from itself, like, you know, isn't this clever? And there are things in here that I just think are trying a little too hard to sell jokes that have already kind of been out there in the culture, like, you know, the Do They Know It's a Funky Christmas sequence is like, I just feel like I've heard and seen this joke, and the fact that it's this cast delivering it doesn't, it still doesn't quite go that last bit of distance between me and just, I don't know, Tina Fey's self-regard. I don't, like, it's not like she's not good at what she does. I just, sometimes with a Tina Fey product, it's like, are we being instructed? Like, is this a master class, or are you trying to bring us into a story? So, Girls 5 Eva, I'm gonna have to not read the comments for this episode, but it just is not quite my thing generally. I enjoyed this episode. I think this is an excellent presentation, but I'm still not quite sure how I'm going to vote because I don't connect with the show in a larger sense. And I think this episode, for reasons that I'm not doing a great job articulating, but it is somewhat typical of the reasons for that, that it's like, yes, it's perfectly cromulent. It's good. It's witty. It's well performed. I'm all set. I'm not sure why I feel that way. Dave, you talk for a while.
All right. Referring to the American X stories as mini scaries is such like a little punch up joke that works. And the episode is like just full of those sort of things. Grandma was an eye digger. Mm-hmm. All the extended Tina Fey shows have a very common energy to them, whether 30 Rock, Great News, Kimmy Schmidt, this one. And I'm in for it because I love this mix of comedy where it is character-based, but it's also like some slight magic realism involved. And the rules of the universe are elastic when the comedy needs to be let in. That is extremely my level of comedy. 30 Rock is still one of my favorite sitcoms ever. This isn't quite as strong as 30 Rock for me. You know, I don't think a lot of the characters gel to the same extent as they did in 30 Rock. They also haven't had as much time. The new Vivitar VCR prize on Star Search, another mm-hmm. great punch-up joke. Mm-hmm. I didn't love the Lutz storyline in this one. I thought it was kind of one note, and they just kept on coming back to it. And the pranks, they weren't escalated enough for me from one-on-one. I thought they could have gone even larger with that. But overall, I did enjoy this, and the songs are excellent. You cannot deny how catchy Big Pussy Energy is. Not 100% on this episode, but I still think it's canon worthy. So I'm going to vote yes for this. We got a mystery vote here with Sarah D. Bunting. But Allison, what do you think here? Canon worthy, yay or nay?
Yay. And can I also add an additional observation? I almost forgot that there's kind of a running theme in this episode of feminist-leaning shows that started on one streaming service and then got canceled and then mm-hmm. punted to another. So I would also like to say I'm really excited for Girls 5 Eva to hopefully get a much larger audience on Netflix than it ever did on Peacock. Mm-hmm. You know, respect to the geniuses over at The Real 30 Rock, but I don't think they've managed to publicize their shows as much as some of them deserve. So yeah, I think once this gets over to Netflix, I would not be surprised if BPE, the song, got like the full TikTok treatment at some right. point. And yep. I'm excited for that.
All right, Sarah D. Bunting, what's the yeah?
It's close, but it is a no for me. Although son of a dick is going into my vocabulary immediately.
One other throwaway line that I really enjoyed is Wiki, guidance counselor, guidance counts me. Fantastic. All right, so I'm going to say yes too. So that means that... Girls 5 Eva, Season 2, Episode 6, BPE. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time for the winner and the loser of the week, and I have this week's winner, and they are Donald Glover and his brother Steven, who are taking over the Lando show, which everybody thought was dead in the water because nobody ever talks about things after they announce them at Lucasfilm, because Lucasfilm's not really good at project announcements and then making said projects, let's just say it. Justin Simeon was attached for a long time, and literally the day before this announcement, he was in, I don't know, Variety or Hollywood Reporter saying, yeah, I think I'm still attached to the project. haven't heard anything in a while. And then the next day, He finds out with the rest of us that the Glover brothers are actually going to be writing. And I'm happy for that, because that's a lot of talent there. Mm-hmm. Even more excited for the possibility that people in the Glover orbit could be brought into this show. And that's a lot of talent. Donald Glover, you know, I said, like, I don't want to, like, I'm good. I'm set. I only want to do stuff that makes me and my friends happy. So hopefully he's got the right signals from Lucasfilm that they're actually going to do that for this project. Also, I'd like to say there's a good chance this project never happens as well, because that is just sort of how things seem to operate at that corporation. So Knock on wood, it happens and they stay on the series and it is their series that they make. But let's just temper our expectations. Tara, who's this week's loser?
The loser is Stephen Amell. He is the star of Heels, which just came back for its second season last week. He is an actor, yet he has come out against the SAG strike, which he called myopic. He thinks strikes are a bad way of negotiating. Has also been actively promoting the new season, which, as I said, came out Friday. So during the strike, so he's not supposed to do that. Someone added scab to his occupations on his Wikipedia page. That was earlier today. I went back and looked later. It has been removed, but shouts to that person who did that, because that's awesome. Allison, let us know before we started taping. He has since clarified, he thinks, his comments in a long Instagram post, which is basically just like kind of restates what he already said, but it was like, I didn't express it well because I was talking extemporaneously at a con for an hour, and I don't know why I said myopic, sorry, but I'm just so proud of this show that we all made together. It's like, stop it! This is what you're not supposed to do! So yeah, Stephen Amell, big scab, boo. Canada, he is Canadian. We disavow him.
Wow. Oh, bad day for Stephen Amell. Mm-hmm. All right, well, speaking about bad days, you're going to about have, you know what time it is?
It's gay time!
Gay time!
All right, everybody, this is the fourth game time of the season, and everybody has 1 point, so that's exciting. Ooh. Today, we're playing Sibling Rivalry from Rebecca, who earns herself an extra credit of their choosing, plus a free shirt from the EHG store at throughmethods.com, where you can now find the fabulous shirt, Boats. I mean, who cares?
Who cares?
today's game dives into both fake and real gene pools to remind you of actors who've played siblings on TV and real-life siblings who are both actors. In the first round, we're guessing on-screen siblings from other credits. We'll give you the name of two characters and the shows they are from, and you give us the show in which they play siblings and those fictional siblings' names. You get 1 point for the show name, 1 point for each sibling name, so a total of 3 possible points for each question I will ask you. There are no clues. Step and half siblings are included here, and the shows may repeat.
Okay.
So let's get into the steel meal situation, please, Tara.
Oh, thank you. I forgot steel meals were going to be a factor, but I have it right here. And the steel meal situation is as follows. I have 3. Valued guest has 1. That is the end of the situation.
All right. Let's throw it to Picky. He's going first.
We will start with Tara.
All right, we'll go Tara, Allison, and Sarah. Are we ready to play Sibling Rivalry? Here we go. We've got 30 questions. We got 1 challenger equalizer, growth war zone, right in the middle of things.
Yep, that's what it's called.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And we're starting with Tara. So yes. We've got DJ on Hacks and Jack on AP Bio. Those are 2 characters, and we want to know where they played siblings elsewhere on television.
Okay, they played siblings on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Correct, and name the characters for more points.
DJ is D, and Jack is Dennis.
You are correct. D and Janice Reynolds from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Full 3 points. All right, Allison, are you ready?
Yes.
We've got Elliot on Scrubs and Jane on ER.
Oh no.
So those two characters were played by actors who played siblings on another show. Name the show for a point. Name each character for additional point each.
I think I'm going to strike out on this one. This is not an auspicious beginning.
Do you know any part of that? Do you know who played Elliot on Scrubs?
I don't know the names of any characters on Scrubs. I only know their faces.
All right. Here's the thing. Just name a TV show at random. I just want to see if you get the point. If you get the point, I'm going to double it because it's such a stab in the dark. Here we go. Name any TV show from history.
24? I don't know. Why did that come out?
No, that's not right. All right. I'm buzzing on that one. No Steel Mills? Nope. All right. We're looking for Becky and Darlene Connor from Roseanne.
She was on ER?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Eventually, we all were.
All right. I feel less bad about that now.
That was way past when I was watching it.
All right. Sarah D. Bunting, you got 90210's Brenda Walsh. Who's the boss? Samantha Maselli.
Okay. They were both on Charmed. Playing Prue and Phoebe Halliwell?
You are correct. Wow. Full three.
Wow.
Back to Tara.
Yes. Yeah.
Marty Bird on Ozark. Gary Walsh on Veep.
Oh, okay. They were siblings on Arrested Development. And they were Michael and Buster?
Okay. Michael and Buster Bluth. Yes. All right, Allison, here you go.
Yes.
We've got, how do you say this? I'm gonna butcher it first time and somebody correct me. Jack Languishy from Deadwood.
Languish? I don't know. I don't know that either.
I know the character, but I don't know how to pronounce it.
Okay, I'm just going to leave that in since nobody knows it. Okay. I don't feel so bad. Jacob Wheeler from Halt and Catch Fire. Those are your two characters. The actors played siblings on another show.
Is that Succession?
It is Succession.
Woo!
Okay, then Logan Roy.
Correct.
And Ewan?
Yes! Full three.
Okay, there we go.
Yes.
Well done.
Nicely done. All right. Principal Bolin on 13 Reasons Why, Sarah. And Pete Wilder on Private Practice.
Christ. Like, I was the only person above the age of 25 who watched 13 Reasons Why. Who played the principal? Golly. What was the other show? Private Practice?
Yeah, Pete Wilder on Private Practice.
Oh, shit. Okay, I think the show is Wings. And the characters' names are... fuck. It's Helix Head. Why do I keep getting Helix Head clues that I don't know the answers to? Oh, Tara should steal me all this. Their names were... I don't remember. I can't stall anymore. Sorry. I don't know.
Anybody actually know character names from Wings?
I only know one.
Which is?
Brian.
Yeah, Brian's one of them. Brian Hackett and Joe Hackett.
Joe
Hackett!
All right, Tara.
Yep.
Georgina Sparks from Gossip Girl. Kendall Hart from All My Children.
Okay, they were siblings on Buffy the Vampire Slayer. They were Dawn and Buffy.
You are correct. Full three. Back to Allison. Sarah Connor in Terminator, The Sarah Connor Chronicles. And Stuart on 30 Rock.
Oh, God. Okay, so Game of Thrones? Okay, and then Cersei and Tyrion Lannister.
You are correct. Nicely done. Full 3 points. Sarah D. Bunting, Erin on The Office. Sally Draper on Mad Men.
That does not help me. And the... What was the fucking show she was on? Was it Sabrina? Was that the show? Okay, don't know.
All right. Anybody know that one? Have a guess at anything? That is Kimmy, K-I-M-M-Y, and Kimmy, K-Y-M-M-I, from Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
Huh. Oh.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm not sure if they're sisters or they're sisters. I'm not sure.
Right.
Wife sisters.
Right.
Lorelai on Gilmore Girls, Tara.
Yeah.
Casey on Sports Night.
They were siblings on Parenthood. And then they dated, which is creepy. And their characters were Sarah. Oh, God.
Sarah Braverman.
Ah! Adam Braverman.
And Adam Braverman, yes. Nicely done. Back to Allison. Joan Harris on Mad Men. And Veal on Arrested Development.
Good Girls. And, correct. Oh my God, I don't know their character names, so I'm just going to say two random women's names. Let's say Nicole and Jessica.
No. You're not like super far off. Beth and Annie.
Mm. Those are women's names, all right.
Yeah. Damn it.
Yep.
All right, back to Sarah. Allie McBeal of Allie McBeal. Philip Jennings from The Americans.
Oh, yeah. Okay. This is Brothers and Sisters. And his name was Kevin. And her name was... not Sarah. Her name was...
it was annoying.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah.
No offense to anyone who, listening who has this name.
Her name was The Republican. God, what was her name? Kitty. Name's Kitty.
Yes, nice pull. Ooh. Right at the end there. All right, last question for everybody before we get into our score break. Switch gears.
Okay.
For Tara, Robert Kardashian on The People versus O.J. Simpson American Crime Story. Jules Cobb on Cougar Town.
Okay, they were siblings on Friends. Those are Ross and Monica Geller.
Correct. Full 3 points there to Allison. Mabel Pines on Gravity Falls. Eugene on Flight of the Conchords.
Oh, no. Okay. What We Do in the Shadows?
That's a good guess.
No.
That's what I would guess.
It's going to be tough to pull the characters if you don't know the show.
Charlie and... Beth. I'm going to recycle all the same.
All right.
Love it.
Tara, what are these?
This is from Bob's Burgers.
Yeah. Louise and Jean.
Louise and Jean.
Yeah. Okay, Sarah D. Bunting. Van Palmer on Yellow Jackets. Dexter Morgan on Dexter.
6 Feet Under. David. And Claire.
Fisher. Whoops, sorry. No, yeah, that was actually correct.
That's certainly correct.
Yes, very correct. All right. We are halfway through. Let's get them scores.
All right. I have 15. Sarah has 10. Allison has 7.
All right, Allison, that means you are in the Grossworth Challenger Equalizer Zone.
Woo!
Every time it's slightly different. All right, this is how it works. I have a selection of Trivial Pursuit boxes here. You can choose from the original purple TV expansion pack from Trivial Pursuit from the early 90s. That's when it was published. You can get the 90s edition, the themed 90s edition, the themed 80s edition, the Pop Culture 2 box, and an off-brand box I bought at Goodwill. That is weird.
Just you called choose one Television of those. Trivia or something.
Yeah.
Off-brand and weird.
All right. Off-brand and weird is a little different in that love there are it. Only 5 questions, not 6, and each question is about a different decade. So you have to answer 3 of the 5 questions to get some points. But we'll go in opposite order. So I'm going to give you the more recent questions first in order to improve your chances of getting questions right. So here we go.
Come on. How many points does she get if she gets it?
3.
3. And if she gets the little card, 6?
6.
All right. Good Big luck. Points.
All right.
Nice.
Your first question is about the 90s and on. Home Improvement took place in what city?
On a soundstage in Burbank?
What was the setting of Home Improvement, if I may change the question?
Oh, no, I do not. I've seen so many episodes of the show, and I don't know this answer.
Throw out an American city. Working class American
Detroit.
City. Detroit is correct. All right.
Wait, what?
Yeah, it was.
Great.
Okay, good luck on this one. 80s. Who was MacGyver's boss? MacGyver. Who is MacGyver's boss? If you get this, I'm giving you an instant win. No. Peter Thornton.
Sure.
70s. What triggers David Banner to change into the Incredible Hulk?
Being angry?
Being angry, yeah. All right. 2 questions left. You need one of them for 3 points. This is from the 60s. Ooh, something that happened recently in our show. What actor played Napoleon Solo in The Man from U.N.C.L.E.? Not the movie, the TV show.
Peter O'Toole, I don't know.
Robert Vaughn. All right, you need this one, but it's from the 50s, so it's getting hard.
Yeah.
There were only two shows back then. It's fine. You got this.
Not true. The answer is a show I've never heard of. So good luck.
Great.
Allison,
okay.
Good luck. I'm just going to say. What mid-50s series was filmed at real LA area hospitals and clinics for authenticity? Mid-50s.
A medical show from the 50s.
Well, I think you could assume that, but that wasn't part of the stated question.
No. Just.
It could be like about a guy who only kills people in hospitals. Any idea?
General Hospital.
No. Has anybody heard of a TV show called Medic?
No.
Because that's what the answer is. So close, but no cigar. Sorry, Allison.
Good effort, though.
All right.
That was tough.
We're going to roll into round two. We're talking about real-life siblings. We're tweaking the formula a bit. I'm going to give you one actor in this show that they were on. I'm going to give you another actor in the show they were on. They are real-life siblings. You give me the names of those real-life sibling actors. 1 point for each. So maximum 2 points this round for each question. Tara.
Yep.
Dud Dudley, Lodge 49. Mm-hmm. Wes Gardner, Scream Queens. Gardner.
Okay. That's Wyatt Russell. And I think Oliver Hudson.
Yes, they are real life siblings. 2 points. This is question 17.
Oh, this is pretty cool.
It is for Allison. Finn Walden on Homeland is your first character. Kimberly Finkel on Sex Lives of College Girls.
The Chalamets, Timothy and Pauline.
You are correct. 2 points. Sarah D. Bunting. Michael Bluth on Arrested Development. Mallory Keaton on Family Ties.
That is Jason and Justine Bateman.
You are good for two. Tara, this is question. 19. Dr. Temperance Brennan on Bones. Mm-hmm. Jessica Day on New Girl.
Those are the Deschanels, Emily and Zoe.
You are correct. More 2 point answers. Allison, Ethan Burke on Wayward Pines. Johnny Drama on Entourage.
Nice.
Oh my God. Why am I blanking on Johnny Drama's real life name? This is bad.
First of all, it's always fine to not remember things about Entourage. So just for the record.
Give yourself permission.
Okay. The Wahlbergs?
Good guess.
Yeah.
No. Anybody?
The Dillons.
Matt and Kevin.
Oh God.
Back to Sarah. Jack Donaghy, 30 Rock. William Vanderwoodson on Gossip Girl.
It's too many syllables.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
William Vanderwoodson.
Also, which fucking Baldwin is that? All right, so it's Alec Baldwin. And...
Roll the bones.
Yeah, it's the one you think, probably.
It is. All right, because there's, you know, the fat one and the Jesus-y one. But I think it's the other one, Daniel.
Daniel's
no, not Daniel. Shit, Billy. Is it Billy?
It is Billy. Yeah. Too late, but it's Billy. All right, Tara.
Yes.
Dr. Catherine Avery Fox on Grey's Anatomy.
Right.
Claire Huxtable on The Cosby Show.
These are, it's Debbie Allen and Felicia Rashad.
You are correct. 2 points. Back to Allison. Allison Dubois on Medium, not well done. Anna on Ratched.
Oh my God, the Tunnies?
Nope. Anybody?
The Arquettes, right?
Yeah, but I don't know who the second one is.
Patricia and Rosanna.
Right, yeah.
Oh, right.
Okay. Sarah.
Good for her.
Yeah.
Agent Dominique DePiro on Mr. Robot. Marion Brooke on The Gilded Age. Sarah D. Bunting, the one person that watched Mr. Robot out of all of us all the way through.
I know. Dominique DePiro.
Agent Dominique.
Sorry. Agent Dominique DePiro. I think this is Gummers, and it's one of them is Mamie. Let's try it. Okay. Then I don't know.
Steel Mail.
Okay, Steel Mail. You got two possible points here.
Louisa Jacobson and Grace Gummer.
You are correct. Nice. Those are the names.
The one Gummer I didn't guess.
They're all doing Three Sisters and a theater festival this fall. I'm very excited.
My hometown's most famous product.
All right, you've got two left for Tara.
Okay.
Michelle Tanner on Full House, Wanda Maximoff on WandaVision.
Okay, this is, well, Wanda is Elizabeth Olsen, and Michelle is Mary-Kate and or Ashley.
You are correct, yes. Allison, Xavier on The After Party, Daniel DeSario on Freaks and Geeks.
DeFranco's, James and David.
You are correct. 2 points. Back to Sarah D. Bunting. Catherine the Great on The Great. Susan Ford on The First Lady.
Catherine the Great on The Great.
Or should I say Catherine the So-So?
I don't know the answer to that.
We were looking for Elle and Dakota Fanning.
All right,
everybody has one question, so let's get a quick score update.
Okay, Sarah and Allison are tied with 13. I have 23.
Okay. All right, well, let's just play it through. Tara, yep. Here's your last one.
All right.
Junior Marsh on The Righteous Gemstones. Martha Mitchell on Gaslit.
Oh, okay. This is these are the Roberts's, Eric and Julia.
You are good for two. All right, Allison, your last question. Owen Milgram on Maniac. Monica Lewinsky in Impeachment, American Crime Story.
Jonah Hill and Beanie Feldstein.
Correct. I didn't realize they were siblings until I read that. And then I read it. I'm like, oh, of course.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Once you know, you can. Yeah. You definitely see it. Yep.
All right, Sarah, here's your last one. Leonora Folger on Only Murders in the Building. Milton Armitage on The Many Loves of Dobie Gillis.
I believe that this is Shirley MacLaine and Warren Beatty.
You are good for two at the end. And that is regulation.
Oh my God, I'm exhausted.
Let's hear the scores.
Okay, Allison and Sarah finished with 15 each. I had 25.
All right. Just before we go, I had a tiebreaker that I had to make because we only had 32 questions there. So here is a tiebreaker. You can shout it out. I'll give you a steel meal if you get it right. Which of these five sister shows is the middle sister by premiere date? 1,000 Pound Sisters.
Oh, no.
My Sister Sam. Sister Sister. Sisters. Three Sisters. Which of those is the middle of the pack chronologically by premiere date? 1,000 Pound Sisters, My Sister Sam, Sister Sister, Sisters, Three Sisters.
Sister Sister.
Sister Sister by Sarah D. Bunting is correct. Yes. 1,000 Pound Sisters 2020, My Sister Sam with Pam Dauber, I think, 1986. Mm-hmm. Sister Sister, right in the middle, 1994. Sisters a little before it, 91. Three Sisters, 2001.
Tara!
Tara!
Good job, Tara.
Nicely done, everybody. Thank you, Rebecca. Well, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We started on the road to Reservation Dogs finale as we took a look at the start of season 3 before going around the dial with stops at This Fool, Minx, and Hunted. Tara had enough of that BPE to get Girl 5 Eva's BPE into the canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Tara was the winner of this week's Game Time from Rebecca. Next up is the commercials of 1988 plus the TV 101 pilot on Extra, Extra Hot Great. And right here on EHG Prime Next, it's Only Murders in the Building, Season 3. Remember.
We're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano.
When you laid off gluten for a week, I was your champion.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Son of a dick.
And Allison Herman.
Rosie's the Riveter and Perez.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. Right here on Extra Hot Great.
bagged and tagged.
John Sewell, Jack Langrishe, commonly known by his nickname, Comedian of the Frontier, was an actor, showman, and production manager who had been operating different theaters before arriving in Deadwood, South Dakota in 1876.